Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, a new study suggests that the powerful feel less empathy. Does that have implications for societies? Then, advances in neuroscience are making giant leaps in understanding human behavior. What might it mean about free will? Our next guest has conducted a study on empathy, which suggests that power blunts our ability or willingness to feel empathy toward others. With us is Dr. Michael Inslick. He is a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto and the author of Stereotype Threat, Theory, Process, and Application. He's co-author of Power Changes, How the Brain Responds to Others. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Michael Inslick. It's great to have you here. Your study explores power and empathy. I thought it would be important to first explore the importance of empathy.
Maybe I should start by thanking you for having me on your show. So I think empathy is an emotion that allows us to connect to other people. It allows us to kind of understand what they're going through, what they may be experiencing themselves. In a way, it's, you know, sharing the emotions of someone else, maybe trying to put yourself in the shoes of someone else, and then kind of understanding, you know, where they're at in a sense, what they may be thinking, what they may be experiencing, and what their intentions are. So it's a very, very valuable process that allows us, well, first of all, to maybe reach out and help people. But it also helps us understand, you know, what people are feeling and doing and thinking, and then we can predict how they're going to act, and then we can act in accordance with how they're going to act. So in a way, it allows us to read their minds. And that's a really, really valuable skill to have.
Your study explored power and empathy, essentially finding that powerful people experienced less empathy using the brain's mirror system. So first of all, what is the mirror system and how did you test this in the lab?
The mirror system essentially is a set of brain regions or networks that seem to be activated when a person, let's say, engages in an action, but also when they watch someone else engage in the same action. Now, this may or may not be related to mirror neurons. So this kind of a famous story of these Italian scientists in the early 90s discovered this class of neurons in macaque monkeys. And more recently, it's been discovered that humans as well have these class of neurons. And these neurons seem, again, to fire when engaging in some sort of motor action, like you're reaching out with your hand, for example, but also when observing someone else do that same kind of action. Now, some people have argued, although it is somewhat controversial, that neurons maybe, or maybe more broadly, this kind of mirroring system plays an important role in empathy. Maybe it helps us understand what people are going to do, their intentions, and in a way it allows us to kind of mentally simulate their actions, and as a result, understand those actions, and for potentially to maybe change our own behaviors as a result of what we predict they'll do. That's in a sense what this mirroring system is. And now you also asked how we assessed this in our study. So really what we did is we used a technology called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is a powerful electromagnet that we kind of hover it over a person's scalp, and we aim it over certain parts of the scalp, which are right on top of the brain, of course, and we aim it on parts of the brain that are related to motor movements. In our case, we aimed it over parts that would enable a person to, let's say, grasp with their hand. So what we do with this, the transcranial magnetic stimulator, or TMS for short, is it depolarizes certain of these brain areas, these motor brain areas, and as a result, one is able to more readily measure kind of spontaneous motor activity in the hand. So I can actually put electrodes on a person's, let's say, muscles of their hand, the muscles that are involved in grasping. And after I kind of applied this magnet, I'll more readily see this kind of spontaneous firing in the hand. Now the key here is, we have participants in some conditions, we have them watch a video of a hand squeezing a ball. And the typical result is that after a TMS application, you find a facilitation of these motor potentials or of electrical potentials that are responsible for the muscle movement. And this occurs when people are observing a hand relative to when they don't observe a hand. So right there, there's already evidence that people's brains are mentally simulating these hand movements. And you need this kind of electromagnet in a way to kind of prime the brain in a way so you can measure it in the actual hand. And after our actual study, we took advantage of what we know about TMS and about this motor resonance system. And then we basically evoked different states of power in people by having people write about times in their life when they did or did not experience power. So by power, I mean social power, being responsible for other people, maybe being the boss, making decisions, versus being powerless. You know, you are someone that's responsible for you. You are, you know, a subordinate. You kind of do another person's bidding. And we can all remember times when we've been, you know, in a either high in power or low in power. And then we also had a control group where we kind of just asked people to, I think, write about their favorite season. So something neutral, nothing to do with power. And then we had observed these hand movements as we kind of applied this electromagnet. And then we measured the electrical activity over the muscles that are involved in grasping. And what we found was that people who were, you know, primed to remember a time when they were high in power, they showed a marked decrease in resonance. So they didn't tend to mentally simulate the actions of this disembodied hand relative to people who were either in the neutral control group or especially relative to people in the low power group. The people who were, you know, remember the time when they were low in power, they were especially likely to mentally resonate with others, at least as reflected in muscle activity in the hand.
One thing that I think this also suggests is that this is fluid. It's not static. The people who, when they felt power, but in the next moment, you could have asked them to recall something that was a time when they weren't feeling power.
That's absolutely correct.
This ability to feel empathy for another or to behave empathically would depend on the circumstance in the moment.
Absolutely. So I hope I made clear in the writing of this article that we're not trying to say something, you know, global or, you know, trait-like about people high or low in power, because our manipulations, we just took ordinary college students and we had them remember times when they were high or low in power, and they, you know, anyone could have been in any one of those two groups. So you're right. It suggests that this is fluid and that it's maybe not so much an ability or a lack of ability in the case of people who are high in power as it is about motivation. So perhaps if you are high in power, you just, you know, you don't care. You know, you don't care to, you know, mentally simulate the actions of another person because, you know what, I've got the power, I'm responsible, and I'm not reliant necessarily on other people to get what I want. Own power, even situationally, well, now you rely on other people to maybe get what you want, and as a result, it pays for you to pay closer to what they may be feeling, to what they're doing, so that you can predict what they're going to do and then kind of act accordingly. So absolutely, this is a motivated process.
It's also a little bit reminiscent of another study I remember that suggested positive emotions and negative emotions were incongruent to the extent that when one experiences positive emotions, they can't experience negative emotions simultaneously.
Well, you know, there's probably some debate about that. There's a whole field of research on mixed emotions, so we're feeling ambivalence. So it's possible. I suspect you probably could feel a little bit of both. But I think if you're trying to say that, you know, these are kind of states of mind where you can get yourself into, I think, you know, that's probably right. You know, it's kind of like a willingness to go there. I think that's really what, you know, what we're trying to say with this study.
The changes in the brain are not permanent. They are going to change with each situation.
Unless we're talking about extreme cases, so for example, maybe people who suffer from autism, where some people have argued, you know, one of the symptoms may be a lack of empathy, or maybe a lack of ability to empathize. So unless we're talking about extreme cases, I think we all have in our capability an ability to get in the head of someone else. And when we do get in the head of someone else, then, you know, we're doing different things in our minds and our brains. So yeah, changes are, you know, again, are very, very fluid. And really, I think it's really helpful to think of this as, you know, do you feel like empathizing with someone? Are you up for it? Or are you, you know, too busy? So this kind of reminds me of a famous quote by Elie Wiesel, who wrote that, you know, the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. So just not caring. When you don't care, you don't engage in those, let's say, the mental operations that you need to get in someone's head and to understand how they're feeling. People, in our study at least, who were primed to be high in power, expect, you know, the downstream consequences of the brain responses are a product of, you know, this indifference, of a lack of willingness, maybe, at least in the moment, to kind of mentally simulate other people's actions.
Another of your studies looked at in-group and out-group biases for empathy. How would you say this fits in with your findings here?
In some other lines of work, we have looked as well at this kind of motor resonance system, a system that is thought, at least by some people, to be really important for understanding people's actions and maybe simulating their actions in your own mind and brain, and really thought to be important potentially in empathy. And what we found was that, and again using this on a different brain technique, this is looking at electroencephalography, so EEG, we found that people's ability to kind of mentally resonate is intact, but it is especially heightened when you're resonating with someone who belongs to, you know, what social psychologists call the in-group. So in this case, it was someone who shared your racial or ethnic background. So if you're white, you are very able or willing to resonate with someone else who's white. If you're black, you're able and willing to resonate with someone else who's black. And we also had Asian groups and South Asian groups from the Indian subcontinent. And we found this, you know, this in-group out-group effect. The key here, though, is that when people looked at people who were from a different group, so when the white people looked at black people, or when, let's say, South Asian people looked at white people, or black people for that matter, we found that people were less likely to resonate with other people. So they're less likely to simulate the actions of another person when the other person was of a different racial background than oneself. And we found this to be the case for actions. So when people were kind of in their brain activity, as people were kind of assuming having a mental activity of resonating with other people who are, you know, doing a simple motor action. But we also found it with emotions. So when people observed other people who were, let's say, expressing some kind of distress or sadness, again, people resonated with the sadness. They kind of maybe felt a bit of sadness themselves, but typically only when that person belonged to the in-group, and much less so when that person belonged to the out-group. And as well, we also found a relationship between people's attitudes about groups, so their levels of prejudice towards various groups. And we found that levels of prejudice directly predicted the amount of, let's say, motor resonance that you showed in your brain. So the more prejudiced you were, the less you tended to mentally simulate the actions of out-group people. Now, to get back to your question, you asked how this relates to a current study. I mean, I think at this point I would be speculating because we didn't actually measure power in these studies of intergroup relations. But it's conceivable that, you know, there may be power differences between groups. Maybe another way of thinking about it is that the same process may be underlying both things. So again, in our studies with power, I was suggesting that this is a fluid process and that really it's about a willingness or a motivation to, let's say, empathize or to get into the head of someone else. Well, maybe the same thing occurs with groups and out-groups. Maybe when I'm watching someone who's an out-group member, who maybe I don't have lots of contact with regularly, maybe I don't really have much exposure to them regularly, and maybe as well if they are, let's say, a stigmatized group, low-status group, well, then I don't necessarily need to, let's say, pay attention to them and to get into their mind. So I'm just not willing to kind of do that, to mentally simulate the actions of these other people. So again, it speaks to a willingness. And we actually have data, it's unpublished at this point, which corroborates this idea of it being a motivated process. So in this study, what we had people do was the same kind of idea, observing in-group members and out-group members doing simple actions. In our typical study, the action is like literally lifting up a glass with water, putting it to your mouth and putting it back down. So in this follow-up study, we actually kind of added an emotional quality to these actions. So we had the neutral one, the glass up and down, but then we also had people, you know, giving a thumbs up, positive kind of maybe a joyous, like accepting kind of gesture. And then we also had people giving, this is, you know, videotaped images, people giving you the finger, which is clearly aggressive, antisocial, threatening. And what we found is that, especially for the threatening gestures, that it doesn't matter if a person belongs to the your in-group or to your out-group, you are resonating with that person. And that's because now you've got a threat in front of you, and now you're probably motivated to understand what they're going to do, what they're like, because, well, they may attack you. So it pays for you to understand what's going on, what their intentions are. You may pay especially close attention to those kinds of gestures. So this, again, speaks to this kind of idea of this being a fluid, motivated process, and this lack of resonance may be more about a lack of willingness as opposed to a lack of ability.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that empathy can be actively constructed.
Yeah. I'm not sure that I'd use the word constructed, but it certainly can be, let's say, deployed. Some people have argued the ability to kind of mind read in this way is a fundamental ability that a few other animals, if any other animals, really, really possess. So maybe some of our primate relatives may have some rudimentary forms of mentalizing or kind of getting to the heads of their conspecifics. But we have it to an exquisite degree, and it's probably what is one of the ingredients as to why our species is so successful. Some evolutionary psychologists and biologists have argued. It can be allowed for, you know, the formation of large coalitions of groups. And with groups, you can build societies and cities. So all this requires, you know, an ability to get into someone's head, to trust them, to understand them. So I think we all have this ability, again, with exceptions, you know, these are going to be based on some diseases or disorders. But we all tend to have this ability, and then it's a question of whether we want to deploy it or not, whether we want to kind of use this thing or not.
Well, Michael Inslicht, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you very much for having me.
Michael Inslicht is a professor of psychology at the University of Toronto. He's the author of Stereotype Threat, Theory, Process, and Application. He's co-author of Power Changes How the Brain Responds to Other. When we come back, how much do our brains determine who we are? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Neuroscience has uncovered so many clues about human attitudes and behaviors that have far-reaching consequences. But scholars and doctors disagree on what it does and does not tell us about what it really means to be human. Are we our brains? Do we have free will? How far can neuroscience take us in understanding ourselves and our communities? With us are two experts. Patricia Churchland is a professor emerita of philosophy at the University of California, San Diego. In 1991, she won a MacArthur Fellowship, and her books include Brainwise, Studies in Neurophilosophy, Brain Trust, What Neuroscience Tells Us About Morality, and her most recent, Touching a Nerve, The Self as Brain. Sally Satel is a lecturer at Yale University, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and co-author of One Nation Under Therapy and Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. You've both compiled this wealth of research about our brains, and it's raising a lot of questions about who we are and how much of our lives our physicality determines versus our free will. Maybe the place to start is what exactly these MRI scans are showing us and where you think they are useful and not useful.
Well, fMRI scans, that's functional magnetic resonance imaging, are scans that show activity in the brain. They're called an indirect measure because they don't reflect, well, they do reflect neural activity. They don't measure neural activity directly. They measure the oxygenation of the blood that is flowing to those neurons. So scientists consider that a good proxy, although they are actually working on ways to record from or measure activity in neurons directly. What we see when we look at a brain that is so-called lit up, let's say someone is looking at a picture, you will see increased activity in the visual cortex, among other places. And that means that the area that processes visual information is working harder. The same for the auditory system. If you're listening to music, that will be differentially affected. Then there'll be activity other places because you'll have emotional reactions or thoughts, and those too will be reflected in neural activity. The hard part about brain imaging, and I should add that any neuroscientist would say that these studies are very much in their infancy, so we're going to be able to do a lot more in the future. But right now the question is, how much detailed information about mental states can we tell from looking at a brain that's illuminated via brain scans or fMRI? And it's a wonderful topic for research, but when the brain scan migrates out of the lab and into the public sphere, and let's say into a courtroom where the judge and jury are asked to infer what the criminal either was thinking, or more specifically, could he form intent? Does he know what he was doing? Was he able to control himself, for example? The extent to which we can infer this kind of knowledge, which makes is enormously important in the forensic setting, the extent to which we can accurately, reliably, and validly infer that from a brain scan at this time, one always has to say at this time when talking about neuroscientific evidence, is very, very low. And that is why brain scans are only used in courtrooms in capital cases, where the threshold of evidence is so low that they're used there. But they're constantly banging on the doors of the courtroom. Defense attorneys would like to use this. So they're not ready for prime time in that domain. That would be one example of where basically that would be a premature application of brain imaging. And that's one part of the book. My co-author and I, Dr. Scott Lilienfeld, a psychologist, talk about premature applications. We also talk about the concept of neurocentrism, and I'll explain that and then I'll pause. Neurocentrism is the idea that explaining behavior, complex behavior, at the level of the brain, at the neural level, is somehow the most authentic, the most true, the most accurate way of looking at behavior. We coined that term specifically with reference to drug addiction, which of course is a process, a very complex process that takes place at the level of the brain, but it also takes place at the level of psychology and in the environment and in society. Those are all levels at which the behavior of people who use drugs are influenced. So we set out a cautionary warning not to focus all your effort and attention and government funding at the level of the brain when one is trying to research addiction and learn how to help patients, because there are so many other dimensions we should look at that we argue in the book are the ones at which we actually do intervene, and that's where we can help people, and that's to say at the behavioral level and at the social level.
It sounds like in a thumbnail sketch you're saying don't oversimplify, and there's a lot of complexity here that we need to take into consideration.
Exactly. Those are two main points.
This is Pat Churchland. I think that there's much in what you say, but on the other hand, it's extremely important from a neurobiological point of view to try to understand what changes in the brain when an animal, human or rodent or what have you, when the animal becomes addicted. And I think actually one of the areas of research that has flowered quite tremendously in the last two decades is a much deeper understanding of the reward system and of very specific changes that happen in the reward system, and that changes that have an effect on whether the animal behaves in an addicted way or not. And this is, of course, not the only area in which you might intervene. Nobody thinks that. On the other hand, it is extremely important to understand what actually happens in the brain when an animal is addicted. And the results really have been quite extraordinary and, I think, very important. So, yes, of course, one wants balance and, of course, the environment is important, but it's also important to understand really what the mechanisms are, I would think.
Speaking of addiction, and we've done panels on addiction on this program as well, animals do get addicted to drugs.
Absolutely, they do. And of course, what we can do in animal studies is look not just with a crude tool like a brain scan, but we can actually record from single cells and see differences. We can see whether there are differences in gene expression as a result of the addiction and so forth. Now, not everybody needs to be interested in those things, and I realize that the science is not far enough along so that the results are producing interventions that might be usable in a clinical context. Nevertheless, that may actually be a useful direction in which to go. It's not the only direction, but it is a useful direction.
Both of you have expressed some interest in the way the brain changes, the idea that it's ever-changing, that it's always learning, so that it's not static, and that behaviors and such can change. Why don't we take a look at that? Sally Satel, why don't you start?
Definitely. You're referring to plasticity, but the kind of a big umbrella term for lots of changes that happen in the brain between synapses and neurons and within neurons themselves when people learn things. I mean, you could argue that anytime you learn something, you have changed the brain. You never step in the same brain twice, which is just a play on the never stepping in the same river twice, because it is changing all the time. And the clearest example, again, is learning. You can actually observe changes in the brain when animals, and when people as well, you know, learn new things. I do think I have to respond a little bit to what Pat said, but in that I agree with her completely. I think learning about mechanism is imperative. That is the first step to repairing all kinds of problems we have, from the most, I'd say, strictly neurological, like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, these kinds of things, maybe epilepsy, schizophrenia in its early stages. I mean, it's imperative. And in addiction, it's going to teach us a lot, too. I think it's going to be more promising to teach us about aspects of motivation, reward, memory, impulse control. I'm personally sort of skeptic it'll ever translate into medications for addiction. And I could be wrong, and we'll be talking here again in a few years and maybe examining that.
I think medication is the only way in which there could be a translational effect from basic neurobiology to medicine. I think there are other kinds of interventions as well.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Some of them behavioral, but some of those may actually be suggested by discoveries about the nature of those physical changes that we see in the addicted brain. And so I do think it's terribly important.
Let's go back to this idea of change, because I think it also applies to the issue of addiction and how somebody who may have formed those kinds of brain mechanisms that are related can also change. But this applies to a much wider range of issues related to all of us. One description, I think this was in Sally Satel's book, was that it's like an ever-changing ecosystem. And Patricia Churchland, one of the things you wrote was that as the brain does learn, it actually has to build new circuitry. So can you explain what happens?
Well, of course, the brain begins in the womb. And very early on, there are cells produced that somehow organize themselves into circuits, and circuits that organize themselves into big networks that then organize themselves into systems. And we don't actually know in detail a whole lot about how that's done. But you might think, well, you know, the brain is quite immature when you're born, so there's going to be lots of change. But it turns out that the change really does continue throughout life. And one of the most striking changes, I think, that happens is, first of all, a great sort of proliferation in the bushy part of the neurons. But then there's also a pruning back. And there's a pruning back that happens in early childhood, but then there's a major pruning back that happens in adolescence. The view seems to be at the moment, but this is still very speculative and not nailed down, that the pruning back that happens in adolescence is an important way allows the brain to kind of work in a slightly new way altogether. And that the structures along the midline get reorganized with regard to the structures on either side. And that reorganization, in a way, produces a kind of different style of thinking. And if the pruning does not happen, I mean, there's the question. So what happens if you don't get pruned back, if there isn't a sort of streamlining of the circuitry? And one view is that this may indeed be related to the onset of schizophrenia that we see that happens when it does happen in sort of mid-adolescence to early adulthood. So one hypothesis at the moment, and this could turn out to be quite wrong, but a leading hypothesis is that the pruning back and the reorganizing of basic cortical circuitry is absolutely essential in adolescence.
Sally Sateau, how does this apply to other aspects of our thinking, emotions, behavior, attitudes, this ever-changing ecosystem that you described?
When it comes to, you've mentioned addiction, so let's go back to that. One development that we write about in the book that we take a dim view of is the conceptualization of addiction, again, as a brain disease, again, illustrating the neurocentric view. And people who find that a helpful way to think about it will say, well, it's a brain disease because addiction changes the brain. And that is very true. The addictive process is correlated with many changes in the brain. But what's important is that these are changes that still allow choice under certain circumstances. I work with addicted patients, you know, every day, so this isn't just a theoretical conclusion on my part. For one thing, most drug users spend many hours not using drugs. In fact, they spend them working. I'm not saying they're down the hall from you, but, you know, gas stations or as waitresses, these people, a lot of them in our clinic, most of them, in fact, work, and they use drugs at various parts of the day. During those non-working times, these people are obviously functional. They make lots of choices. Do they even go to work that day? Do they take their kid to school or let someone else? All these things. They could make the decision that day to go into treatment. Now, they have their reasons for not doing it, and I respect that. People use drugs for reasons, and they decide not to quit and to quit for reasons. But there's that. Then, even more important, and what has much greater clinical implication is the fact that people who are addicts, very heavy users and users of methamphetamine often, are responsive to contingencies, which is to say to rewards or sanctions. There's a lot of data on the so-called contingency management. So that even though they have brain changes, they are still able to respond. Whereas somebody, for example, with Alzheimer's disease has the kind of brain changes that don't allow them to respond to incentives. If you were dementing, I couldn't say to you, I'll give you $1 million if your memory improves, or I'll punish you if it doesn't. It's just not the kind of brain changes that permit that. But in addiction, people can respond, and getting back to the plasticity point, as they get better, those brain changes resolve and they strengthen activity in other circuits as well. So the plasticity helps them, you know, it gets them into addiction, so to speak, and out of it as well.
There's two other areas I wanted to explore. One, Patricia Churchland, you looked at what this means, what all the brain research is telling us in terms of do we have a soul, yoga, meditation, and the changes that we see in the brain as a result of doing these things. And what does it mean for spirituality and all these things that we feel when we take part in these activities?
I was really writing about my own take on these things, and my own take being that the way the evidence is shaping up now, it appears that there really is only the brain. That is to say, there isn't, in addition to the brain, a non-physical soul. Now, having said that, of course, I want to emphasize that the brain is organized at many levels. There are systems like the visual system. There's big networks that are composed of smaller networks, which are composed of neurons, which are composed of very complex organization of channels and so forth. So there's many levels at which you can talk about the brain. But overall, it doesn't appear that Plato or Descartes was right when they talked about a non-physical soul that does the thinking and the feeling and the deciding and so forth, that there really is just the physical brain. And, of course, physical brains are in a context, they're in an environment, social and physical, but the social and physical environment has its impact via having an impact on the brain itself. So my interest in the book was really to kind of address the fact that many people can feel awkward about that, or that at least that idea takes some getting used to. And so I wanted to explain that in some ways it seems to me rather liberating. And it also is liberating, at least for the reason that it's more comfortable to me, that it kind of lines up well with the science. So, for example, if you thought there was a soul that lived on after death, you might think that that soul would have all your memories. But since memories are really patterns of connection between nerve cells in the brain, and since those nerve cells die when your brain dies, that there really isn't anything for a soul to have by way of memory. And I think once you sort of see how the science fits, then it is a very comfortable thing to realize that the here and now is what you have to deal with, not thinking so much about the possibility of going to paradise at a future time. But having said that, you know, I mean, I think I explained in the book that I do a lot of yoga. And I do have these really quite wonderful experiences that I don't have at any other time when I'm in the resting state after a really good, vigorous yoga class. And I think that we can see that there are differences in the brain when you go into that state. And that's one of the things that functional MR actually has revealed. And so I think of these as rather special experiences of the brain that you can get in these unusual ways. I think some people might get them by chanting. Some people might get them by prayer. I happen to get them in yoga.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the advances in neuroscience and how much they tell us about who we are. One of the questions would be then, does it actually change your brain in this sort of way that we've been discussing to do this kind
sure.
of practice?
I think it does, because it took me quite a while to learn to be able to really relax in the way that you need to after a vigorous yoga practice. So I think that there are changes, and some fMRI scanning work done on veteran meditators, people who've been meditating for a long period of time, and seeing how their brains look during meditation compared to a novice meditator. And you do see interesting patterns of activity. Now, we don't know what that means, those patterns of activity. We only know that there is a difference. But nevertheless, that there is a difference does tell you that probably the advanced meditators have learned a certain sort of a skill, and that skill is embodied in the interconnections of the neurons wherever it is that they happen to be. The other thing about plasticity that I think is terribly important is it has to do with aging and the recognition that physical activity in particular is very important for keeping the brain, as it were, spry. The discovery of about a decade ago that there are actually new neurons made in the adult brain was really, really surprising and striking. But then the follow-up discovery, this was, of course, initially done in rodents, the follow-up discovery was, of those neurons that are made, how many survive? Well, it kind of depends on whether the animal has a lot of physical exercise or not. Mental exercise, not so much. Physical exercise seemed to be the key. And I think that was a very striking finding as well.
Well, let's also turn to something both of you have discussed in your books, and that is aggression, crime, and then Patricia Churchill, you also went on into war and genocide. Sally Satel, you started to talk about how there's this whole area of neuro law developing and how brain scans are being used in cases. We have had on the air other scholars who have talked about, for example, how serial killers have different kinds of brains than other kinds of people. How do we explain this? And does it produce a significant question in law?
Well, they certainly do present very, very complicated questions in law. Let's even stipulate that there are differences in the brains of serial killers. It's very possible. I mean, to the extent that these people are clinically designated psychopaths and there may be some problem with some pathology in their limbic circuitry, which basically causes them to know or rather doesn't affect their knowledge of the difference between right and wrong, but very much affects their feeling of the difference between right and wrong. I'm fairly certain that's what you've heard. I don't really question that. What we have to question is, just because we see something in the brain, it's a very compelling way for people to, and this is why it's found such a home in the courtroom, as counting as an excuse for behavior. Now, if you take the case of Andrea Yates, which is a famous tragic case from 2001, she was a Houston mother who drowned her 5 children in the bathtub. Most people remember that. She had a severe case of postpartum depression, or psychosis, I should say. She thought she was the devil, that she was contaminating the children with evil, and in order to save them, she had to kill them. And now she was ultimately exonerated by not guilty by reason of insanity, which I personally think was the right way to go. However, had her brain been scanned at this time, with the way our technology is at this time, we would not have been able to infer much from her brain as to what kind of behavior she was capable of. So that's one example of how outrageous behavior can be, and in this case, how clinically insane, which is to say that, well, she did know what she was doing, but her actions flowed from such a deranged premise that she met the threshold for legal insanity. And on the other hand, we can find things in the brains of criminals, you know, all the time. The question is, from a legal standpoint, how corrupting were those brain changes of a person's capacity to reason and control himself? And we get so much information from interviewing the person, from the history, from medical records. There's a great constellation of data that we draw on, but in rare cases is the brain image enough to tip the balance because we can't interpret them with such precision.
Patricia Church.
Yeah, I mean, I basically agree with that, and that the problem is that we can't see a nice causal relation between a certain abnormality and a specific action. And of course, the other thing that is sort of surprisingly true is that there's actually non-trivial variability between everybody's brains. And I think one question you want to ask yourself is, suppose you took a whole lot of scans of psychopathic brains, and then you intersperse them with scans of normal people. Could you pick out the psychopath? And the answer seems to be no, you can't actually. And that there's quite a few people who are absolutely normal in every respect that you would care to think about, whose brains may show lower than average prefrontal activity. And there may be psychopaths whose brains show above normal activity in the prefrontal cortex. So we really aren't, I think, and here I do agree with Sally, that we really aren't yet in a position to identify a pathology as exculpatory, as excusing somebody. But if I can just go back to Andrea Yates, you know, she was actually convicted.
Right, at first, yeah.
She was not found not guilty by reason of insanity. And the reason really was that she had phoned the police immediately after drowning the last child and said, I have done this thing, you need to take me to jail. So that established that she was cognitively aware of what she did. That is, that she knew the difference between right and wrong as defined within the meaning of the law. And so she was actually convicted and went to jail. Of course, we all know that she was a deeply disturbed person. But within the meaning of the law, I think that was actually the right decision.
It was reversed, ultimately. But it's true that at first she was, and then it was reversed.
Yeah, yeah. The difficulty, many lawyers do not want to plea not guilty by reason of insanity because the person then must go to an asylum for the criminally insane. And it's an open-ended sentence. That is to say, in order for you to be released, you have to demonstrate that actually now you are sane. And in many cases, that's not an easy thing to do. Sanity defense is a very, very tricky defense, and it's used extremely rarely, actually.
Sometimes there's a brain injury that causes aggressive behavior, and that was part of where the theoretical ideas came from. But I want to take it one more step, Patricia Churchland, which is then you took this and went on to warlike behavior, genocidal behavior, and looked at this from all kinds of perspectives, social psychology, cultural aspects, physicality. After all of this exploration, what have you concluded about the warlike behavior?
Yeah. I think, first of all, there is a tendency for people to say, well, there must be a gene for genocide. And I think that really is a bit fast and loose. There really isn't much justification for that. On the other hand, what I was really interested in, scientifically interested in, was the nature of aggression. And whereas altruistic behavior and deeply social behavior seems to be new with mammals, aggression goes a long, long way back. And so I was very interested in what we actually know about the circuitry for aggression, how it can be changed, how it is that animals manage in a social context. Now I'd be talking about mammals. How is it that they manage to suppress aggressive impulses within the group? And why is there often, and not just in humans, but why is there between group lethal interactions? And of course, in the case of humans, and it's probably well after humans left Africa and populated Europe, there do seem to be these extraordinary outbreaks where one group viciously attacks and kills and maims and otherwise is really quite terrible to the other group. And the answer to your question is there's not actually all that much research at the circuit level on the nature of aggression. So there are a number of labs who are now working on it, but there wasn't as much information that I was able to get about the nature of aggression as I was even, for example, about the nature of altruism and caring behavior within social mammals.
Well, Sally,
it's obviously a very, very important part of being able to defend yourself and also of being a predator. And what I was postulating, and this is really a guess, but other people, I think, have sort of weighed in on this as well, is that there is a link between aggression and excitement or aggression and pleasure. And not always, but a sort of basic platform link. and that helps us understand why under some circumstances we see aggression let loose in a way that is sort of consistent with the aggressors being very excited, very joyful, very happy, and doing these absolutely terrible things with great joy.
Sally Satel, respond to that and also answer the big questions that we are trying to answer here about free will and the degree of free will that we have, given all of these things we're talking about. The big question, are we our brains?
Oh, well, yes, I will answer the free will question. Oh, my goodness. No, that is the remains the eternal question, and I'll define it. To me, the free will question is, can we reconcile moral agency with the fact that, as Pat said, we are material creatures? We clearly are our brains to the extent that every thought, feeling, emotion, intention, desire is produced, is made subjective through our brain. For activity of our brain, I don't debate that, and frankly, no scientists do. The question is, though, is really, to me, a philosophical one, which I just formulated. How can we be both neurally determined in this way and yet free? I know that many neuroscientists and maybe philosophers would say that we can't, and that is the hard determinist view. Those who do say that because we are living in a material world and we're biological creatures, that we ultimately cannot choose. And because we can't choose, because basically our choice at the moment of making that decision is a culmination of all kinds of genetic and biological and historical factors that have come before, we cannot be held responsible. And some scientists seem to think that the more we learn about the brain, the more we can elaborate on the mechanisms that do underlie the neural determinism, the neural circumstances of action, that we will come to endorse that view, and we'll have to revise our criminal justice system and basically short of retribution. And I am sympathetic to, I guess, what would be called the compatibilist view, which is to say that as long as people with functioning brains, and not everyone has a well-functioning brain, hence the not guilty by reason of insanity and other excusing conditions, but as long as people can reason and that their actions flow from reason, that they're responsive to reason and they control themselves, that they intend their actions and can deliberate on those actions and their plans, that they can be held responsible.
Patricia Churchland.
My interest is really in separating out the notion of responsibility from the notion of self-control or control over behavior. And it's very clear that many animals, certainly all mammals, have a capacity for self-control. And that there are variations amongst individuals in their capacity for self-control, by which I mean the capacity to defer gratification, to suppress unacceptable impulses, to cancel an action once started, and to focus on a task regardless of distractions. And we can see very well, for example, in the case of rodents, that there are some who are really, really good at all of those things and some that are less good at it. And we actually understand quite a lot about the nature of the pathways that are involved. And the same is, I think, true of the human brain, and that is that we have the pathways and the circuitry for self-control. There is individual variability, but that variability can also be augmented and changed in various kinds of ways. And psychologists are actually quite good in dealing with children who have problems of self-control, who can't defer gratification, or who have difficulty with impulse control. The legal question, I think, is very different. And the legal question is a question about the practical foundation of the criminal justice system. And ultimately, the criminal justice system is about public safety and public security. If someone loses control and does a terrible thing and they're apt to do it again, then the point of the criminal justice system is to protect other people by removing that person from society. So I don't see any difficulty in principle in claiming that people need to be held responsible. We actually count on the causality of the brain as we try to rear children and produce good habits in them, and habits of self-control and habits of behaving properly in the social group and so forth. We're actually exploiting the fact that there are causal relationships in the brain that we are changing by our approval and our disapproval of children. But that's not just true of children, that's also true of adults. And a good part of the criminal law has to do with deterring adults from doing things they might otherwise be inclined to do. And that also is an instance of exploiting the causality of the brain in order to hold people responsible when they do flaunt the law. So I think that the notion of self-control is very important here, and it's very real, and we can understand the nature of the pathways. We understand loss of control when those pathways are destroyed or damaged and so forth. So I don't think that there is an issue, and I don't think it's terribly widespread within neuroscience, this view that Sally outlined, that neuroscientists think that it's just a causal machine, so nobody's responsible for anything. I think that's a terribly small minority view.
I think they don't believe that people deserve to be punished, though. I think that everyone believes in a criminal justice system, as you just said, as you articulated well, you know, to protect, to maintain order.
Well, that's, but that's the ultimate platform for a criminal justice system. But it also does involve the need to, as it were, manage retribution, because the victim and the victim's family are undoubtedly going to feel that they want to have justice done. Not everybody does.
Sally Satel, Patricia Churchland, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. Patricia Churchland is a professor emerita of philosophy at the University of California, San Diego. In 1991, she won a MacArthur Fellowship, and her books include Brainwise, Studies in Neurophilosophy, Brain Trust, What Neuroscience Tells Us About Morality, and her most recent, Touching a Nerve, The Self as Brain. Sally Satel is a lecturer at Yale University, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and co-author of One Nation Under Therapy and Brainwashed, The Seductive Appeal of Mindless Neuroscience. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chiprinankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.